Thank you very much, Chandra. I'd like to start off by thanking the Book Review Literary Trust for this invitation, which I regard as a very considerable honor. I would also like to not thank them for the past month of sleepless nights that I had trying to decide on what subject do I speak on and how do I go about it. It's been very, very tough because Nikhil was not the easy person for whom one could just dash off a lecture. I remembered his warm and affectionate friendship. I remembered his immense sense of curiosity and inquiry about people, about politics, about the ambiance of the world that we live in. And I also remember a couple of little experiences that we shared. I mean, these are occasions for small anecdotes. Nikhil and I shared the experience of very politely declining a Padma award, explaining that such awards intervene in the autonomy that we like to claim in our professional work. So that was one common experience. The other common experience was a little bizarre and quite amusing. During the emergency, Nikhil dropped in to see me one day and suddenly said to me, "Your house is very interestingly located," because it was behind, as the normal saying goes, it was on the backside of another house. And he said to me, "Your house is very interestingly located because you have one entrance from the main room in the front and one entrance from the service lane. This would be ideal for meetings because people would come, some would come from the front and people wouldn't know that there were others coming from the back." And I said, "Fine, let's use it for that." And so we had two or three meetings which didn't really amount to anything except, you know, good conversation and chatter about what was going on, whispered conversations of the emergency. But it came to an end when one evening at a reception somewhere in town, somebody walked past my brother Ramesh and whispered in his ear, "Warn your sister, her house is being watched." So that, I'm afraid, was the end of Nikhil's great idea of having these weekly andas with people coming in from the front and the back. But the problem, of course, was that how does one choose a topic which in many ways both reflects the kind of things he was interested in and worked on and reflects our homage to a man of his caliber? Nikhil was a respected intellectual figure, and he in turn respected academic opinion about public matters. And that is where a relationship between him and some of us comes in. He provided space to those who questioned the nature of this interdependence of society and politics. Today, I have a feeling that space has shrunk and the intellectual parameters seem to have narrowed. It also seems that those in authority and those influencing public opinion have less respect for what we call the public intellectual in these days than they had before. I would therefore like to speak about whether or why this is so, a subject that I suspect would have interested Nikhil. And it becomes pertinent, I think, where there is a concern, as there is with many of us still, with the kind of society we want and why we want that kind of society. So in the talk today, I briefly mention and refer to what I think is implied by the presence of public intellectuals. I'm afraid as a historian, I cannot help but instinctively go back in time. So I'll begin with mentioning a few persons from the European past associated with the thinking that in modern times gave rise to the public intellectual. And then some references to the Indian tradition, where there were people who played a similar role. I'm not suggesting a connection between the two, but I think that there are parallels in many ways. And finally, I should suggest what could be the role of the public intellectuals and why there should be a greater visibility of such persons in our society today. Public intellectuals frequently concern themselves with issues related to human rights and to the functioning of society, such that it ensures the primacy of social justice. These issues cover an immense span. I shall choose a couple from amongst them, those that I think should have priority. One is our choice of authority, whether it be religion, the state, or anything else, and how do we appraise that choice? And the second is to draw upon up-to-date knowledge and review the use to which knowledge is being put. We must expect that new knowledge may well oppose existing orthodoxies or well-established authorities. How do we handle the opposition? This hinges on the primacy of reason, logical argument in explaining the world around us and its past. In emphasizing the rational, I am not expunging imagination as a process of thought, but the distinction between the two should not be ignored. Such concerns are not recent. They go back to antiquity and they were addressed many centuries ago. I shall mention a few people from the past whose thinking laid the foundation for our right in the present to ask questions from those who are shaping our society. In earlier times, the questions emerged largely from rational argument and logical thinking, but tempered by recognition of the human condition. Their answers did not foreclose the imagined future of a better society on earth and did not require us to wait for heaven or the next birth. Europe claims a tradition of such thinking, and its presence in Indian thought is more often dismissed. But I would contest this dismissal. Societies invariably have to follow the questioning of orthodoxy and authority, at least at challenging moments, otherwise they rapidly become moribund. To turn to the European past, the forerunners of the public intellectual indulged in philosophical questioning, but this thinking also penetrated the political sphere and was reflected in suggested social action. Such persons claimed the right to critique authority, even on occasion they had to suffer for it, as did, as we all know, Socrates. The Athenian Greeks objected to his denying the existence of deities and to his criticism of the methods of justice in Athens. And for this, he was condemned to drink poison. But an important strand of European thinking traces itself back to the Socratic method of the 5th century BC. A statement was subjected to many questions and was prized apart to observe the interconnections of its component parts. These could then be linked causally in a hypothesis and tested. A proposition counterposed by its opposite could lead to a dialectical form of debate. The Roman orator Cicero of the 1st century BC, who exposed the corruption of Roman governors, claimed the right to question whatever he thought needed to be questioned, and used his legal brilliance to do so. In the same millennium AD, the Catholic Church wielded power over kings. This power was subsequently questioned. It was one of the issues that stoked European thought into the movement known as the Enlightenment. Philosophers, with whose names we are all very familiar, such as Locke, Hume, Voltaire, Montesquieu, Diderot, Rousseau, and others, began questioning conventional knowledge and practice. There were disagreements among them and with others, but by and large their questions were conceded because they drew on critical reasoning. This brought them together, apart from the common challenge to the moral authority of the Catholic Church in matters concerning what we would today call civil society. The latter was now seen as essentially secular institutions, some run by the state. Religious exclusiveness and intolerance was viewed as backward. Progress, it was argued, lay in inclusiveness and the tolerance of differences. It was not because of wanting to oppose religion per se that the church was criticized, but because of opposition to the control that formal religion had on the institutions of society, the family, education, governance, justice. The divine sanction of these institutions by the church was rejected. Thus, the source of authority for governance was said to be a social contract among people. Apart from other things, an emphasis on reasoned analysis rather than on just open faith made it easier to locate the mainsprings of social functioning and to suggest changes in society where necessary. However, the public intellectual, as distinct from philosophers, is said to have emerged as a recognizable category in the 19th century, linked to what has been called the Dreyfus Affair. A Jewish captain in the French army, Dreyfus, was wrongly imprisoned, charged with leaking secrets to the Germans. Those opposing this action argued that the general staff of the army, in league with the politicians, had unjustly punished Dreyfus. This accusation, written by Emile Zola, carried the support of a large number of writers, artists, and academicians, all of whom jointly came to be called intellectuals. Eventually, an inquiry divorced from an emotional anti-Semitism declared that Dreyfus was innocent and he was reinstated. The meaning of intellectual then crystallized around the notion that such a person need not be a scholar, but had to be someone who had a recognized professional stature and who sought explanations for public actions from those in authority, even if such explanations required critiquing authority and power. Such questions came more easily if there is a critical analysis of the intellectual tradition of the society. Basing arguments on accepted modes of reasoning involves verifying and analyzing the evidence, even if the historical context changes somewhat the mode of questioning. The notion of rational argument over the last two centuries has, however, faced criticism. Its centrality was questioned in the statement that the premium on rationality cannot provide complete explanations, and that all explanations, rational or otherwise, are equally viable. Critiques based on rational thought can be diverse, depending on the evidence and the logic inherent in the causal explanation. However, although the idiom of critical reasoning may differ in changing historical contexts, critical reasoning itself can and does continue. It is worth remembering that many of the roots of modern thinking, such as liberal values and democracy, by which we describe ourselves as not being medieval or feudal, go back to these debates among philosophers and others. Nor were the debates confined to Europe, since some of these ideas met with confirmation or opposition when they arrived in other parts of the world, initially riding on the back of colonialism. Let me turn now to the Indian tradition and randomly refer to a few persons that challenged existing ideas and practices and who advocated reasoned and logical explanations for change. We have been so implanted with the theory that our ancestors had no use for rationality as an avenue to knowledge, that we tend to ignore our heritage of rational thought. The Indian philosopher who encouraged questions and who explored causality and rational explanations was a close contemporary of Socrates in the 5th century BC, although they lived continents apart and had no links. I am referring to the Buddha. The latter, fortunately, did not have to drink poison. But his teaching was strongly opposed by Brahmanical orthodoxy. It was described as delusional and misleading. This was one among many reasons why Buddhism was slowly edged out of India. It went into neighboring lands where it flourished and in some places became in its own turn an orthodoxy. One of the most fascinating aspects of the history of ideas is the diverse ways in which societies explain their evolving structures. When asked about the origin of government, the Buddha explained that at the beginning of time there was a pristine utopia where everyone was equal and had equal access to all resources. The first change came when families were demarcated and became the units of society. Subsequent to this came claims to ownership of land as private property. These changes resulted in confusion and conflict. So eventually, people came together and elected from amongst themselves one person, the Mahasamatha, the great elect, to govern them and to provide them with laws that annulled the chaos. It was effectively a social contract. But let me hastily add, tongue-in-cheek of course, that neither Rousseau nor Frederick Engels had read the Buddhist texts. This Buddhist explanation contradicts the Brahmanical, where the story involves the gods and demons at war, and the great god Prajapati having to appoint his son Indra to lead the gods to a victory, in which action lay the roots of governance. Divine sanction is essential, and it colors the attitude to authority. The Buddha's notion of the great elected one is in some ways the reverse of the king, who was divinely appointed, concentrating power in himself. The assumptions in the two myths are therefore entirely different. When religion is referred to in early texts, there is, of course, no mention, and I'm speaking of really early texts, there is no mention of Hinduism. a term invented much later. The multiple sects that constituted Indian religion are referred to by their individual names. And when speaking generally, they are assigned to one of the two streams, the Brahmanical, associated with Brahmanical belief, or the Shamanic, representing Buddhist and Jain teaching, the word Shamanic coming from Shamana, which was a term used for Buddhist and Jain monks. This is the form in which the religions are mentioned for over 1,000 years, from Ashoka, Shamanam Brahmanam, in the 3rd century BC, to Al-Biruni in the 11th century AD, who also talks about the Brahmins and the Samaniyas constituting the religions of India. The Sanskrit grammarian, Patanjali, about the turn of the Christian era, provides a curious perspective. Please, would you switch off your mobiles? It's very disturbing. The Sanskrit grammarian, Patanjali, provides a curious perspective when he compares the relationship between the two to that of the snake and the mongoose. Clearly, the debates could be virulent, as happens in societies, where some believe unquestioningly in what they are told, but others raise questions. And then there were the Charvak, also called the Lokayat. They were opposed to most philosophical schools as they adhered to a materialistic explanation of life, making virtually no concession to other ways of thinking. No texts of theirs have survived, but references to them keep cropping up unexpectedly in various nooks and crannies of other texts. The Buddha, for example, describes the arguments of some of these sects as the wriggling of an eel. At the turn of the Christian era, when Buddhism had the patronage of royalty, traders, landowners, and popular support, important Brahmanical texts registered an attack on them as heretics, referring to them as Nastika and Parshanna. From the Brahmanical perspective, the Shramanas, Charvaks, Ajivakas, atheists, materialists, and rationalists were all of one category known as Nastika, non-believers. And this was because they questioned the existence of deity and therefore of the Vedas as the divinely revealed, of the rules of caste practices, of the existence of the Atman, the soul, and their views on karma vary, as some rejected the idea altogether. I'm reminded here when I read these texts referring to all these people as jointly, conjointly as Nastika. I'm reminded of the present day where if you don't accept what Hindutva teaches, you're all branded together as Marxists. The Mamadharma Shastra is almost paranoid about the heretics, calling them atheists and preachers of false doctrines. They are said to be like diseased men and are a source of tamas, a condition of darkness. It is in some ways a time of troubles for the orthodoxy, given that some dominant schools of philosophy were striated with degrees of atheism. That is what makes it an intellectually exciting time. Wherever the heretics had a popular following, the attack on them became stronger. A text of the early centuries AD, the Vishnu Puran, is replete with negative references to a person called Maya Moha and his followers. Delusion and deception, as the name Maya Moha implies, are characteristic of the group. Maya Moha, we're told, collects all the evil ones, the Asuras and the Daityas, today's Marxists, and converts them to his way of thinking. Some of their practices point to their being Buddhists and Jains, such as wearing red robes, removing their hair, not observing rituals, and living off alms. Discourse with them is strictly not permitted, since such discourse is declared polluting. A record of such a dialogue would have been fascinating, but only brief references survive. The Charvak continued to be part of the landscape, even if not always directly visible. Shankaracharya in the 9th century AD refers to their theory of the primacy of matter over spirit. The Sarvadarshana Sangraha is a discussion on major philosophical schools put together in the 14th century by Madhavacharya. It begins with a lengthy discussion on the viability of Charvak thinking, but of course ends up ultimately rejecting it. But if they had no consequence, they could as well have been ignored. This did happen later in the world of 19th century Orientalism. We have to remember that those that ask questions are anathema to any kind of autocratic authority. Similarly, those trying to build a single national identity based on Hinduism alone would not have conceded the significance of teachings that contradicted the Brahman code. The heretics were dismissed by the Orthodox. However, some of their ideas were explored in philosophical schools of the early centuries AD in conversations precisely between the Orthodox and those that opposed them. Logic and methods of reasoning were sharpened. The logicians, and the major ones are interestingly almost invariably Buddhist scholars, the logicians teased out the ideas, especially when discussing the nuances of atheism. Views were not uniform and were widely debated, the arguments sometimes taking an almost dialectical form. Unfortunately, what are difficult to locate are the conversations between philosophers using critical reasoning with astronomers and mathematicians, even more closely allied to rational thought. Aryabhatta, on the basis of mathematical calculation, argued that the Earth went round the Sun. This theory preceded that of Copernicus and of Galileo by a millennium. In Europe, the potential of these ideas was feared by the Catholic Church and Orthodoxy as undermining the Bible and therefore also the control of the Church on society. Galileo had to recant. In India, the implications seem to have been bypassed, possibly because there was no church. But perhaps adopting the heliocentric system may have upset astrological calculations. I'm just throwing this out as an idea, but it's something that is worth pursuing. Astrology was one mechanism by which royal power was controlled by religious orthodoxy. Old knowledge, therefore, continued unshaken in most places. Indian theories of mathematics and astronomy, however, expanded creatively in their own space, but ironically became very influential when taken to Baghdad, which was then the center of what one might call proto-science. In India, meanwhile, other sects provided an ambience in which similar questions were being raised. Scholars questioned beliefs and practices upheld by religious authorities and by those who governed. They, or else they questioned other orthodoxies other than the Brahmanical. Some among them were women, such as Andal and Meena, flouting caste norms who were listened to attentively by people at large, thus creating their own social ambience. But we seldom give enough attention to this aspect of their discourse, focusing as we do largely on religion. Amir Khusro was not unknown to the Delhi Sultans. He provides a poetic view of court politics in his Tughlaqnama, composed in the 14th century, as a form of traditional history. His study of astronomy, however, underlining a heliocentric universe, distanced him from orthodox Islam, as it implied questioning accepted truths. And it was his poetry and musical compositions that gave him a popular status, such that sultans and the orthodox thought it better not to antagonize him. A few centuries later, Eknath in Maharashtra also questioned the control exercised by formal religion. His versions of the Bhagavad Purana and the Ramayana defined his Brahmanical scholarship. This did not stop him from questioning the viability of the social order and caste practices. Turning to modern times, the ideology of nationalism made attempts to reorder society. Nationalism opposed colonialism, but was not averse to theories from colonial scholarship. Social reform movements pertaining to upper caste Hinduism, such as the Brahmo Samaj, the Prarthana Samaj, and the Arya Samaj, suggested new forms of Hindu religious organization and the role of caste. We are all familiar with Raja Ram Mohan Roy and socio-religious reform, but so little is said about his exact contemporary in Tanjore, Sarfoji II, a minor Maratha ruler. He questioned orthodoxy by focusing on the content of education. His reading of Enlightenment authors convinced him that knowledge was based on processes of reasoning and that these were taught through education. The schools he established were intended for this purpose, as were the books and the objects that he collected in the famous Saraswati Mahal Library. Although these movements were not intended to critically question the intellectual traditions, this did occasionally surface. Despite the centrality of caste hierarchies legitimized by religion, the interface between religion and caste was seldom investigated. In the 19th century, Bal Gangadhar Tilak supported the Aryan foundations of Indian civilization and upper caste culture, even if, according to him, the Aryans did have to trek all the way from the Arctic homeland to India. But Jyotiba Phule saw the coming of the Aryans as a logical explanation for the oppression of the lower castes. For him, the Aryans were Brahmins that oppressed the indigenous inhabitants, who were the Shudras. Tilak extended the accepted view. Phule questioned it to explain existing society. Both readings were historically faulty, but Phule was asking an incisive question. There were others who were also questioning the legitimacy of caste and doubting Brahmanical beliefs. Periyar or Idiyar, although not an academic, was known to be as well read as were his academic colleagues. He was critical of the contradictions in Hindu mythology and beliefs that he always dismissed as fabrications of the Indo-Aryan peoples. His rationalism led him to take a strong position in favor of social equality, and more particularly, the equality of women. The people that I have mentioned were not public intellectuals in the modern sense. They were among those who questioned the existing reality as a means of attaining an improved society. They were listened to because they were respected in their diverse professions. The point is not the similarity or other ways of their questions. It is the way in which they reasoned, even if the nature of the questions changed in accordance with the issue of the moment. Such questions are not arbitrary. They have to be governed by acknowledged critical reasoning, and people who question were and are articulate at moments of significant historical change. Moments of historical change coincide with the exploration of new ways of ordering society, as has been happening off and on in the Indian past till now. Public intellectuals playing a discernible role are needed for such explorations, as also to articulate the traditions of rational thought in our intellectual heritage. This is currently being systematically eroded. Mainstream anti-colonial Indian nationalism, the kind that we all, some of us grew up with, and the emergence of a liberal democracy aspiring to be secular, made space for the visible presence of the public intellectual. More than a few took on this role, especially in the years just after independence. They were responsible for wide-ranging debates. Later events, be it the emergency or the genocides of religious communities, heightened our awareness of the need for public intellectuals, if only to speak out and prevent a repetition of such events. We must remind ourselves that Nikhil and others like him strongly opposed forms of censorship and the attempt to silence alternate voices. Today we have specialists in various professions, but many among them are unconcerned with the world beyond their own specialization. It is sometimes said that they are replacing the public intellectuals, but the two are not identical. There are many more academics, for instance, than ever existed before, but it seems that most prefer not to confront authority, even if it debars the path of free thought. Is this because they wish to pursue knowledge undisturbed, or because they are ready to discard knowledge should authority require them to do so? Much has been written on trying to define the public intellectual. Such a person, it is assumed, should take a position independent of those in power, enabling him or her to question debatable ideas irrespective of who propagates them. Reasoned critiques are often the essential starting point. The public intellectual has to see herself or himself as a person who is as close to being autonomous as is possible, and more than that, to be seen by others as such. An acknowledged professional status makes it somewhat easier to be autonomous. The public intellectual of today, in addition to being of such a status, has at the same time a concern for what constitute the rights of citizens, and particularly in issues of social justice. And further, there is a readiness to raise these matters as public policy. A justification for the critique is the claim to speak for society and to claim a degree of moral authority. The combination of drawing upon wide professional respect together with a concern for society can sometimes establish the moral authority of a person and ensure public support. This is a conceded qualification and not a tangible one. In the past, it was those who had distanced themselves somewhat from society that were believed not to have ulterior motives in the changes that they suggested. But this was not always so. Today, formal affiliation to a political party in our times can inhibit free thinking and prescriptions for action, even if it has the advantage of providing a support. As an attitude of mind, autonomy is more readily expected of the professional specialist or the academic. Such persons, and they are not the only ones, can suggest alternative ways of thought and even action regarding problems of the larger society. Such thinking can lay claim to rational, logical analyses. Yet academics today are hesitant to defend what might be broadly called rational interpretations, however sensitively they may be expressed. This is evident from the ease with which books are banned and pulped, or demands made that they be burnt, and syllabuses changed under religious and political pressure, or the intervention of the state. Why do such actions provoke so little reaction among academics, professionals, and others of us who are interested in the outcome of these actions? The obvious answer is the fear of the instigators, who are persons with the backing of political authority. But is this the only answer? Many today comment on the narrowing of the liberal space in the last couple of decades. It was fought back, and now it is upon us again. To question those that represent conventional authority and to demand responsible action needs constant repetition, especially where it involves a negation of justice. The ordinary citizen hesitates to share criticism of religious activities or of contemporary politics on the social media, although the social media today has become the area of much to-ing and fro-ing. More specifically, when it comes to religious identities and their politics, we witness hate campaigns based on absurd fantasies about specific religions, and we no longer confront them frontally. Such questioning means being critical of organizations and institutions that claim a religious intention but use their authority for non-religious purposes. They invoke the rules and regulations of formal religion, sometimes recently invented, in order to legitimize their actions. Their actions may bring murder, rape, and mayhem. Those outside the organization maintain that the values of religion do not preach violence. But that is not the issue. Of course, all religions endorse the same virtuous values. But it is not the values that are under question. It is the beliefs and actions of organizations that act in the name of religion. Can the law be brought to bear against those that disrupt our societies, even as they speak in the name of religion? There are many reasons for the decline of the public intellectual, and I can only mention some. The most obvious, but least conceded, are insecurities generated by the neoliberal culture. What do I mean by this? These have arisen out of the economic boom it was supposed to bring for everybody, but which boom has misfired for most. Jobs have become far more competitive. This adds to existing aggressions and erodes a reliance on human relationships. Almost obscene disparities in wealth further the aggressions. Values are being turned to tinsel with the endorsing of ostentatious activity. The ready acceptance of corruption has become normal. Money is the new deity lavishly worshipped among the rich. The rest wait anxiously for the so-called trickle-down. There is a clash between the excitement of having the right to demand equality, but of its being denied because of new versions of caste and money power. The neoliberal culture and economy cannot be easily changed, but its ill effects can be reduced, provided we are clear that society must be rooted in the rights of the citizens to resources, to welfare, and to social justice. This, after all, was the issue at the time of independence, when the nation-state was created. And I remember in the early years of my life the amount of discussion that went into precisely these issues. If such discussions are to continue, as they should in a vibrant society, and questions be raised, then we have to turn to public intellectuals to bring them to the fore. But beyond that, it also needs a public that would regard the asking of these questions as appropriate. How can we create a public that is aware of what needs to be discussed and why? A public that would respond to questions drawing from critical reasoning. The response does not invariably have to be in the affirmative, but at least the issues for discussion can be put forward and discussed. This assumes, for a start, an educated public. How should we be educating ourselves? This involves both professionals in various disciplines and many public intellectuals who, in part, draw their alternative authority from their professional standing. Today, there are effectively two sources of educating ourselves. One is the informal, indirect, visual media as an oral form. And the second is the formal category of educational institutions. The intermediary here is, of course, the famous, infamous internet. And like the other two, at present, its catchment area does not include the entire society. TV channels imitate each other with panelists playing musical chairs. And seldom do programs investigate the reality beyond the statements that they are making. And everything, but everything, has to be seen in terms of current politics. Is it possible, I am beginning to think, is it possible to have an alternate channel on TV or even a broadcasting station on radio not geared to profit? One that encourages exploring alternate solutions that go well beyond the single bite. Such solutions going well beyond the single bite would really draw on inspirations from a critique of society, economy, politics, and the world around us. How do we finance the voice of those that have more than an immediate interest in society and who are thoughtful about its future? The other source, that of formal education, has to be seen at two levels. The content of education, going back to Sir Fulgi II, and the autonomy of educational institutions, which is what we should be concerned with today. Education is moving out of the hands of educationists, it would seem, and into those politics, politicians, political organizations, pretending to be cultural and religious institutions. This makes it crucial to be aware of how politicians today relate to intellectuals, if at all they do. Ideally, the essence of learning lies in enabling a person to think in forms that are analytical, logical, autonomous, not to mention creative. The first step is to provide information of existing knowledge. The next step is to assess whether there is a need for replacing existing knowledge with new, improved knowledge through the process of learning. The educational system as it works today does not even reach to the first step in most schools. Some suspect that the acute shortage of schools and the poor condition of those that do exist may be deliberate policy arising from the fear of a citizenry that is not merely literate but educated and thinking. Hence the striking neglect of school education in the last half century. We have an absurd situation where there is virtually no preparation, even for secondary school, leave alone university, in terms of how to handle knowledge. Yet we are rushing to open more universities, IITs, IIMs, and what have you. Inevitably, this situation leads to diluting education to the point of being almost meaningless. In fact, to reduce it to what I call LCD education, the lowest common denominator. For most young people, the methods of thinking that are essential to the nurturing of inquiring minds and those that might resonate with public intellectuals are in fact stymied by the very system of education. One is thankful, though, that there are some who do manage to think independently and creatively despite the system, but they don't add up to the critical mass that we require. One might ask, what are the issues that could be raised by contemporary public intellectuals? For the unprivileged citizen, in fact the majority of our citizens, governance continues to be survival in an anachronistic system clinging to its colonial roots. The unjust distribution of national wealth keeps the poverty line high. Caste and religious priorities still prevail, using the same categories that date to colonial times. Colonial administration invented majority and minority communities and encouraged the identity politics of religion. As permanent categories, these disallow democratic functioning, because in a democracy, those that make up a majority change from issue to issue. Reservation in education and employment retained on a permanent basis reiterates these religious and caste identities, whatever the marginal benefits may be. The solution actually lies in a different, an altogether different ordering of society and economy. The ultimate success of democracy requires that the society be secular. By this I mean a society that goes beyond the coexistence of all religions, a society whose members have equal social and economic rights as citizens, and can exercise these rights irrespective of their religion. A society that is free from control by religious organizations in the activities related to these rights. A society where there is freedom to belong to any or no religion. Public intellectuals would be involved in explaining where secularization lies and why it is inevitable in a democracy and in defending the secularizing process. Public intellectuals are not absent in our society, nor are they alien imports. They do have a lineage. Historical change requires us to recognize that their role, or those similar to earlier intellectuals, needs to be extended in our times. Their predecessors added new dimensions to understanding our society. Were they nurtured subconsciously by earlier heterodoxies that explained the human condition through reasoned and logical argument? Were they also nurtured by exercising a secular moral authority over those that controlled society? And closer to us in time, by negating colonial dominance. Public intellectuals, drawing on critical reasoning, are the inheritors of this bequest. The title of my talk is full of questions, and let me end, therefore, with a conclusion that will be one of very many, one at least very long question. I would like to conclude with a long question. It is not that we are bereft of people who think autonomously and can ask relevant questions, but frequently, where there should be voices, there is silence. Are we all being co-opted too easily by the comforts of conforming? Are we fearful of the retribution that questioning may and often does bring? Do we need an independent space that would encourage us to think and to think together?